guys.
K2 Romeo India Whiskey.
My name is Dick.
And at this time we begin the TechNet.
TechNet is run by Dick K2RW and John KC2WGB. Dick and Don, Dick and Rich try to organize this crew of people who gather most Sunday nights for the last 30 years to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, and we try to educate each other. Lots of brain power in the New York City area, in the New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and we gather and share information. We try to tap into that brain power. We're about to find out in the next couple of hours, is there anybody on the East Coast who's interested in ham radio that's not watching the Oscar Awards? We're going to find that one out. Also, we're going to ask for your help tonight with reference to the jamming that's been going on for about 3 years. We'd like you to, John and I would like you to help, so would Bernie, by listening to the input and reporting what you hear. There's an official website where you can tell us what signal strength, what you heard on the input frequency, 146.25, by giving us that information at rfi@limarc.org. I'll repeat that. RFI, radio frequency interference, rfi@limarc.org is where you're going to report that. We'd also like you guys to help us join in doing fox hunting. And when you join that crew, you're going to be headed up by Bernie, K2 Yankee Oscar, and K2 Yankee Oscar monitors very frequently the rfi@limarc.org location. So if you could help us, that would be good. The way a person signs into the TechNet is to get John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes. And you're doing that because you do have a question or a comment for the net.
Repeater, timeout.
A typical sign-in would sound like this. Victor Echo 3, Juliet, India Whiskey. Jim, and yes, it turns out that VE3JIW from Toronto is one of our frequent sign-ins and listeners. So that's what a proper sign-in would sound like. Call letters, name, because I'm so darn forgetful, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. If you're just listening to the TechNet, you need not to sign in and tell us you're listening. I mean, there are many nets where you go through a very long list of people signing in saying they're listening. After 30 years of the TechNet, we believe somebody is listening in the tri-state area or by way of Echolink and IRLP. We believe somebody is listening, and that doesn't have to be confirmed to us anymore. So please sign in if you do have a question or a comment. Okay, if you've got a question or a comment, give John and Dick your call letters and your name and that word yes right now. K2RIW listening.
And to experience. Whiskey at the pole. And I sent you the email. A short subject, levitational over the magnets by the diamagnetics. And to experience.
BHY. Okay, so far we've got Wes and Jim, KD2BHY, and hope one of these days you get a chance to install that external antenna to your handy-talkie. In other words, either a ground plane hanging from the ceiling on a string, or eventually high in the house to make your signal stronger, Jim. Jim is one of our newer hams who is building himself a transmitter in a what the hams used to call a tuna fish can transmitter, a QRP rig, among other things he's building. Alrighty, we've got Wes and Jim. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Please give me your call letters, name, and the word yes right now. K2RIW.
Good. I've been.
Okay, I heard a voice. Give me your call letters again, sir. K2RIW.
Again, 2 Echo Oscar. Just been a while. But we're still having a very good evening.
Okay. You were there 50% of the time, Rich. N2 Echo Oscar. And I'm not quite sure, but I know you did have some further hospitalization. And maybe that's where you're calling from tonight. Alrighty. As I said before, we've got
RFI. Did that correct? Did I get that correct, Fred? KQLIW listening.
I must not be enunciating well tonight. It's K. B. R.
Okay. I now know that there's a more to the call letters. There's a B in there somewhere. Kilo Delta 2 India Foxtrot Bravo. I'm going to try that combination. And Fred. Is that what you said, Fred? Over to you, Fred. KQLIW.
Delta India Foxtrot. The name is.
Okay, this time we got Kilo Delta 2, Delta India Foxtrot. And I think your name is Fred. Give me a roger if I got that correct this time. KD2DIF, KQLAW. Go ahead, Fred.
Better radiator here. The name is Brad. Is in short for Bradley. Call me Sandy as well.
Much better copy that time. Bradley or Andy? Okay. Kilo Delta 2, Delta India Foxtrot. All right, we got you. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now and the word yes. K2LIW.
K-A-2-Y-H-Y, Steve. Yes.
Okay, we got you, Steve. K-A-2-Y-H-Y. Never heard of you. Steve and I had quite a few conversations in the last couple of days. All right, one last call. Anyone else to sign for the TechNet? Because you do have a question or a comment. Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW listening. Okay. No further person heard that time. And once again, any interference that you hear, please do the reverse button switch on your rig. Listen to the input frequency, 146.25. Look at your rest meter, tell us what you see, and give us your call letters and that report by going to rfi@limark.org. Radio frequency indication, radio frequency interference is what RFI stands for, rfi@limark.org. And Bernie KQIO will be monitoring that hourly, probably. And if you'd like to join the effort to become part of the fox hunting crew, to hunt down the jammer in the New York City area, we can certainly need your use your help. As I said last week, we've got two choices. We can either light a candle or curse the darkness. We can do something about it, if you know what I mean. With a big enough crew and enough reports, eventually it'll be stopped. There's an extremely unhappy, probably disgruntled, and I am guessing disabled person in the New York City area who many hours of the day or night has nothing better to do but to jam the local repeaters. And so we're going to have to convince that person that this is not the right socially acceptable behavior to continue doing it for such a long period of time. It represents many things, if you know what I mean. Okay, first person on our list was Wes, and I'm going to make a couple of guesses first. Wes, let me drop. And that is, there are a number of YouTube videos in which you see suspension of a superconducting object. Whenever you get a object that is capable of being cooled at a liquid nitrogen temperature, 77 degrees Kelvin, and you have superconductivity, one of the side effects of was it Lenz's law? No, it's Faraday's law, among other laws, is that a shorter turn, a turn of wire that is superconducting, will not allow the amount of magnetic field in the circle of wire to change. If you can first establish a magnetic field and then make the wire superconducting, that's exactly what they do, so to speak, with those superconducting magnets at the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, then you're able to maintain an extremely strong magnetic field with no further power supply required. Ordinarily, to maintain those magnets at the LHC would require lots of megawatts of power continuously, and you can't do that. You'd be draining all the power of the local towns, if you know what I mean. So those superconducting magnets, and there's also superconducting magnets used inside of an MRI machine where you're trying to create a 1 or 2 Tesla magnetic field and maintain it without putting a whole lot of power into it. cooled with liquid nitrogen, and you sort of press it into the magnetic field, put it nearby a magnet, and you force a certain amount of magnetic field inside of the object, and then it will levitate. In other words, it will not allow, once it has become superconducting, any further change in magnetic field. It will not allow an increase or a decrease. As the levitating object tries to move closer to the magnet that's on the table, so to speak, you're attempting to make the magnetic field in the superconducting coil or in the superconducting object increase because you're trying to get it closer. It won't allow you to do that. Therefore, it produces what you and I would call a bucking magnetic field. It won't allow any change. Therefore, it won't allow you to get closer, and levitation takes place. And there's various YouTube videos in which you can have a ring of ordinary magnets and a superconducting object and make it go around the ring. There's lots of interesting experiments with superconducting and strong magnets, particularly the neodymium magnets that we're able to get a hold of these days. I haven't had a chance to see your video, Wes. Let me drop for a second. I'm also going to mention that I should have mentioned during the introduction that quite possibly Glenn, KC2QIQ, later on will be continuing our discussion about what we believe is a electromagnetic wave in free space. An RF wave in free space, what does it really look like? Is there really an T and an H, or a B and an H present? And as you guys have heard over the last couple of weeks, I'm questioning that, proposing at least thought experiments, and maybe some real experiments downrange, in which we'll try to confirm that. So, as I see it, magnetics is where the magic really happens. In the case of an electric motor that you and I would use in your washing machine, your electric automobile, or whatever, the magnetics are what's really doing it. You could make a motor out of electrostatics, but at the macroscopic size, at the normal size that human beings would use, an electrostatic motor would have very little torque. Magnetic motors can have essentially any amount of torque you want, just a matter of design. And magnetics, I think, is the major effect as to how a radio antenna radiates a signal. Magnetics is the effect that's really going on when levitation is taking place. So anybody who wants to study magnetics, I think you're getting to the heart of the problem, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So studying magnetics is where it really happens. That's where the rubber meets the road. And everybody knows from their experience, by holding two bar magnets on a table, try to push them together, north to north, south to south, and you've seen the repulsion. Or when you have a north and south coming together, you've felt the attraction. We know how it feels. And by way of a piece of paper on top, and you sprinkle iron filings on it, you get a bit of a view of what the lines of force must look like. You see those rings of magnetic lines going from the North Pole all the way around out in space back to the South Pole of the bar magnet. So we've got a bunch of hints as to what a magnetic field, where the lines go, how it acts, and whatever. But you ask the average person, what is it? It's not easy. It's something that you see, you can feel, you can touch, so to speak. You watch it happen. But what really is it? What really is a magnetic field? Is it a photon in space? I kind of doubt it. It's like a physician that doesn't know quite sure what you've got. He says, I think you've got a virus. Well, that's one way of saying, I'm not sure. And what really is a magnetic field? I think we're going to be asking ourselves that question for a long time to come. So I'm making some guesses that the video that you may have put on the website, which Bernie also, K2IO, collects, is where it's a common point we go to in which we can all be on the same page and look at the same website by going to Bernie@HuntFamily.org. Bernie@HuntFamily.org is where you can get a hint as to which websites we're talking about during many of these discussions. We're not trying to keep secrets as to what we're talking about during the TechNet. TechNet.com. I said .org, it's .com. Sorry about that. Bernie at Hunt Family.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater.
again, that's Bernie@huntfamily.com. I keep making that mistake. And once again, to repeat, when you do hear interference and you flip to the input and you make a measurement, whether you listen to it in the normal mode and you're looking at the S meter on your transceiver, or what I've done on many occasions, if you have to have an all-mode receiver, and you go to the single sideband mode on the reverse frequency, 146.25, that allows you to listen to a signal that's about 15 decibels weaker when you listen in the CW mode. And I've done that on a number of occasions, and that's given me a lot of information as to direction of arrival, strength of signal, probable location, and so on. So there's multiple ways to do it, knowing that you've got other modes of operation of your all-mode transceiver, if that's what you're using on 2 meters. There's a big learning curve there, which you can make some very useful information and report it at rfi@limoc.org. Okay, I made a bunch of guesses that you can tell, Wes, as to what I think your discussion might be is going to be, and I'll pass it over to you to correct me on all that. N2XJN, first guy who signed in, KQLIW, you got it, Wes.
The video is leading to living frog, like a living frog. It's about the basic effect of paralytic graphite, which is a strong diamagnetic material, and it's man-made from graphite. It does have a very interesting properties. Not only is there magnetic, but it tends to transport heat well across the plane of the sheet, but poorly through the thickness. Whenever I hear that you're talking about a very fascinating subject about the electromagnetic field or the electromagnetic waves, and in respect to the magnetic part, it always puzzles me a possible connection between some basic properties of the magnetism or magnetic materials, which is now magnetic, paramagnetic, and ferromagnetic. Let me drop. What in the nuclear the structure of those materials is makes certain diamagnetics to levitate, and this is a physical body, it does have a weight and is able to levitate over the magnet. Scientists made an effort to levitate the frog, as the frog is made mostly of the water, and the water is mostly is middly diamagnetic. The water is repelled by the magnet and makes the frog levitate through which it makes a pretty cool effect for the children to attract them to this kind of science. We know that the only the static field of the magnet from the bottom of it, and the diamagnetic that we utilize, which is a pearly graphite, does not need any effort of itself just to levitate. Those are a few comments on it. There is another one, which is a bismuth material that is very much diamagnetic, but we're talking about times more diamagnetic than it does not need to be a superconductor, or it does not need to be in the low temperature. It's a room temperature.
Yeah, a person can find out quite a bit about what is diamagnetism by Googling that word, diamagnetism, and most likely by way of Wikipedia. I think Wikipedia and Diamagnetic will give you quite a bit of information as to what it is. There's at least three or four kinds of properties of magnetic materials be described. Paramagnetic, diamagnetic, and I may have to
kinds of magnetic properties, paramagnetic, diamagnetic, and so on. And by Googling that word, paramagnetic, diamagnetic. Diamagnetic, I think, means a material that will not accept magnetic lines of force flowing through it. That's my very simple explanation. This is not one of my areas of strength. But by going to Google and Wikipedia, I think we can find more about it. So, to be able to levitate a biologic organism, a small frog, for instance, and there's been some websites on that, and on the assumption that they're real and not just a phony, you got to worry about the phony websites, YouTube videos. There's a YouTube video that went viral in which four people with their cell phones around the table turn on their cell phones and some kernels of popcorn are put in the middle of the table, and you're led to believe that the radio signal coming out of the cell phones, the four cell phones, heats up the popcorn kernels and that they then pop. It turns out that it was really a movie being played in reverse. Somebody was dropping already popped pieces of popcorn down onto the table. You think they were popping and going up when the movie was played backwards. And when you study the YouTube videos enough, you find out there was one set of four people with Western clothing, another set of four people with Scandinavian clothing, another set of YouTube videos of people with Oriental clothing doing the exact same experiment in front of the exact same table, but using the exact same cell phones, but changing their clothing, and you're led to believe that various people have done this with pure fraud. Turns out the amount of radio signal you get out of a cell phone is so small that it couldn't possibly do that. Your microwave oven can do that, and it's only running close to a million times stronger in watts per square centimeter by comparison to your cell phone. And yes, a microwave oven can pop some popcorn. You got to be careful. Some of these YouTube videos are exciting to look at. Some of them even go viral, and some of them are a pure farce. I believe the ones, though, where you see a frog being suspended. I believe the suspending frog video is real, and in a minute I'm going to pass it back to Wes for some further comments on that. So I wonder if that's the main thing that you are indicating with that video you're bringing to our attention, Wes. QXJN, KQLAW.
First, everything goes through the properties, which is diamagnetic. Third, create a magnetic field specifically. So, that's why it's a magnetic field. And the question is why? Opposing the field produces resulting force. In the nuclear structure over here. The paramagnetic force is the material that creates the magnetic field in the same direction as the externally applied magnetic field, but does not retain magnetization after it's removed. And then you have a ferromagnetic material that creates a strong magnetic field in the same direction as an externally applied magnetic field and can retain some magnetizations. Usually, the iron is pretty much recognized, but also nickel, cobalt, and plenty of others. But as far as the levitating frog, they have been using a strong magnetic field, about 16 tesla, to levitate the frog. And the diamagnetic field over 30 times more bigger than the one that is achievable from the strong neodymium magnet. And the frog made mostly from the water was levitating at pretty much over the surface. Don't remember, but I believe about 10 inches. So quite remarkable experience. The video is not funny. I believe the name of the video is K&J Magnetics Water in Diamagnetics. I didn't send you the link for it yet. Back to you and text you.
Pretty fine, Wes. Modern-day MRI machine, I think, runs in the vicinity of 1, 2, or 3 Tesla. It's a huge machine with a great big super.
extremely strong magnetic field. One Tesla, which is 10,000 Gauss, is a really big magnetic field. Most of the handheld magnets would have great difficulty coming anywhere near that amount of power. By the way, as I say, when you're hearing this jamming on the input, please give us your report at rfi@rimark.org. The jamming is now coming up to a strength of S7 at my location. So I suspect that at least one of these guys is maybe mobile and moving in my direction already. So 16, so I think I heard you say the frog suspension was 16 Tesla. And very few of us would be able to produce anything anywhere near that amount of magnetic field. So I'm going to pass it back to you, Wes, for a repeat on that one. Did you say 16 Tesla to suspend the frog in 2XJN, KQRIW?
Yes, it is, N2XGN 16 Tesla 16, which would be 160,000 Gauss to levitate a probe. The probe was a pretty big one, and it levitates quite high. But my question would be, what is so special in the molecular structure if we would like to either concentrate on the domain or to concentrate on the nuclear bonds of the diamagnetic, paramagnetic, and ferromagnetic that make diamagnetic reduce the magnetic field? Paramagnetic is at the same time does not retain any magnetization, and ferromagnetic retains magnetization. This puzzles me, and would we have any kind of connection with your investigation over the electromagnetic wave, which is extremely interesting subject. Back to you.
Yeah. What in the world is really going on when that frog is being suspended in that super strong magnetic field? I know for a fact that except for the nearest except for the inches from your transmitting antenna, we amateurs are not likely to produce anything like that amount of magnetic field. So that it's not something we're likely to experience. And the real magnetic field is part of a radio wave in free space. Is much, much weaker than that. But I see it from free space. It conducts a magnetic field. It's nowhere near as good as a good piece of iron or ferrite material or things like that. But it still does the job very nicely. And so, and there's no non-linearity about free space. You can put a magnetic field in free space as strong as you want, and it doesn't saturate, whereas... Whereas a magnetic field you put through any kind of a concentrator, like a ferrite rod or laminated steel, things like that. The good news is that with a view of let's say 1,000, it means that it goes through that material 1,000 times better than it comes through free air. That's the good news. The bad news is that every piece of magnetic concentrator, every ferrite rod, every kind of magnetic material that you put inside of a transformer experience saturated at some particular field. In other words, they just a magnetic field internally to go above a certain level. Air doesn't do that. So you, in theory, can create a magnetic field, at least in space, by the strength of a radio signal, as strong as you like, and nothing limits that. In the case of air, when you put a little antenna creating a signal in air, above a certain power level, you might arc over the air in volts per centimeter. You can see 30,000 volts per centimeter of radio signal, you're going to arc over the air. But if you put that system into a perfect vacuum, the arc over disappears, then you've got to be a little bit careful of what materials the antenna is made out of because of the so-called multi-factor effect, which is something they ran into first on the Mercury program. depending on what materials you use for your antenna, in a hard vacuum of space where the Mercury capsule was, if one single electron decides to leave your antenna while you're transmitting, and it decides to go because at this instant of time, the right-hand side of the dipole doing the transmitting, we'll say, is positive and the left-hand side is negative, well, that electron will get up. He'll get attracted to the positive side of the dipole. He'll hit that material. Depending on what the material is made out of, determines whether or not he does, on that impact, create a secondary avalanche effect where the one electron hitting releases two electrons. Then in the next half cycle, those two electrons go from the right side to the left side, and you eventually build up this cloud of a significant number of electrons hopping back and forth, a plasma hopping back and forth between the two halves of your dipole, and that plasma cloud, in the case of multi-pactor in free space, in a vacuum, it becomes an extremely good ionized material, the fourth state of matter, which becomes a dummy load. So you develop your own dummy load in the vicinity of your own antenna. That happened during Mercury, and it became a quasi-life-threatening situation because the multi-pactor effect was absorbing, let's say, 20 decibels of the potential transmit power. I'm going to make a guess that they had 25 or 30 dB of margin on the communication from air to ground. And so the ground path was still able to hear the Mercury astronauts, thank goodness, and they were able to communicate in the presence of the multi-factor. But they rapidly recognized that what their S-meter on the ground stations was registering, versus what it should be registering, was something like 20, 25 dB weaker, getting very close to the threshold where communication couldn't take place. The transmit power on Mercury space capsule was being absorbed right at the antenna before it got transmitted. So multi-factor is the one kind of non-linearity you can get in free space. But that's an electrostat.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That's a kind of an electrostatic effect. When you exceed a certain number of volts per centimeter of E field, a certain strength of magnetic field, then you get this effect. That's not necessarily magnetic. But short of multi-factor and short of using magnetic concentrators like ferrite rods and sheets of steel and whatever, in real free space, most of the time in air, if your antenna is big enough, there is no limit per se to the number of watts you can power, you can put into an antenna. Some of the really potent radar sites are putting in numbers like 10, 20, and 30 million watts of power on each transmitting pulse. That in turn goes into a feed horn, which feeds a parabolic dish. The parabolic dish is a focusing device, which then gives you a pencil beam. And now, because you're taking the signal that wants to go out in all directions, and by your parabolic dish, you're focusing it in one direction like a pencil beam, you can concentrate that beam to make it look 1,000 times stronger than it normally would. That's a 30 decibel gain. So you can have, let me pick a number, 10 megawatts of real transmit power, 30 dB of antenna gain. Therefore, when you're in the main beam of that antenna, after that pencil beam has been concentrated, you stand out there in space and you make a measurement, you think you're looking at a transmitter of 10 megawatts with 30 dB of gain. Therefore, you think you're looking at 10 gigawatts, 10 billion watts of power is what it will look like. It'll have that signal strength. And does an antenna really have gain when you don't put any power into it? There's a whole series of discussions we can have on that. But magnetics, where Glenn and I, or at least I am slowly trying to convince Glenn that magnetics are the major component of a radio wave, the changing magnetic field, and the material that Wes is bringing to our attention of the suspension of a frog in a 16 Tesla field. Explaining how that happens ain't easy. But even that simple little bar magnet you've got on the table.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Now let me make a comment on it.
That simple little bar magnet and what those fields look like and how in the world is that magnetic field internally to the bar magnet, that permanent magnetic field, how is it being generated? That's not easy as I see it. Wes wants to make some further comments. N2XJN. Go ahead, Wes. K2LIW.
I'm trying to find eventually at the end of it a connection between a part of the magnetic field that is a part of the electromagnetic wave and the magnetic field by itself, which is the same principles. but as far as the material that I was mentioning to, the paralytic graphite, bismuth is a kind of a diamagnetic, pretty much, but in the room temperature, the paralytic graphite is much, much more diamagnetic. And it is a synthetic material made by the process called chemical vapor deposition. And it is being made this way that the paralytic graphite methane gas at low pressure, about one torr, is heated to 2,000 degrees of Celsius and very slowly at 1,000th of an inch per hour, the layer of the graphite grows. So that the graphite made this way is very highly ordered, and the layers of the carbon atoms from like a crystal hexagonal sheet, let me drop. So those sheets lie on the top of another like a sheet of mica, and you can separate the layers with a sharp knife if you want to do it physically to make it thinner sheets, but pretty interesting is that this sheet, with its waves as a physical body, is able to levitate and does not need any external power for it. As we know, we have no use of the static magnetic fields of the Earth or static magnetic field of the magnet, but the interesting part of it is the work being done. We can slightly move the piece of the graphite, paralytic graphite, over the surface of the magnet. Is the work being done, and what's going on with the molecular structure of it? Why is rippling?
Wes, I'm going to have to stop you, and you're cheating a little bit. The promise that we make to everyone is that during the first hour, we try to give at least a brief answer to everybody's ham radio question. It is in the later hours that we get into the deeper subjects, and you've slid us into a kind of a deeper subject discussion. There was no simple ham radio-like question in your original question, Wes, so I'm going to have to stop you now. We're going to have to go on to the next person, because we're going to try to keep our promise that during the first hour, people don't have to wait for more than an hour to at least get a brief answer to their ham radio question. The next person on the list was Jim, KD2BHY. Go right ahead with your question, Jim, and how's your, what I call, tuna fish transmitter coming along, tuna fish can transmitter. That's what we used to call it in the old days. I know the article that you're responding to doesn't use those words. KD2BHY. Glenn Cove, I think it is. K2RIW. You got it, Jim. One more call. Are you there, Jim? KD2BHY? K2RIW?
Hi, Dick. I had two simple questions. One is about my transmitter, and one is about the tubes that I found in an old aircraft receiver. I finished my transmitter, but it doesn't work. I pressed down the key, and there was no signal, and the battery got really hot. And I didn't try anything after that, because I was just kind of worried because the battery got really hot. Any suggestions?
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. Your first question would be, when you connect the battery before you press down the key, is current being drawn when the transmitter is not in the operating mode? By putting a volt-ohm milliammeter in the ampere scale mode. In other words, you take your volt-ohm milliammeter, you put it in series with, let's say, the positive lead of the battery. Negative lead of the battery goes to the normal contact on the transmitter. The positive lead, instead of going to its lead on the transmitter, you first put it into the positive lead of a volt-ohm milliammeter, and then the negative lead of the volt-ohm milliammeter you put back to the transmitter. So it's in series with the positive lead, in my example, and set your volt-ohm milliammeter for the 10-ampere scale to start off with. And find out, is current being drawn when you disconnect the battery. Then watch the volt ohm milliammeter and press down the key. And you'll rapidly find out how much current, by that process, the battery is trying to supply. If something is improper with the transmitter, so it represents a short circuit, and it's drawing a very large amount of current, your volt ohm milliammeter will tell you that. So you're quantifying how much current is flowing. If your battery, for instance, is rated for 50 milliamperes on that particular circuit, and you're drawing half an ampere instead, which is 500 milliamperes, it tells you right away that something is in error. And then there's a bunch of steps you can go through step by step to find out by what I would call divide and conquer. What is the error? Is there a splash of solder somewhere that shouldn't be? Is there a miswiring somewhere? So every one of the things that we have built in the beginning, Jim, let me drop. Every one of us in our early days, when we were learning how to solder, we were learning how to wire things, we were learning where the emitter, base, and collector is on a transistor, and we're putting our circuits together. Every one of us, you ask any ham radio operator, if he's got half a brain that still remembers his early days, he'll tell you about the errors that occurred on the first few circuits he built. We all go through that learning curve. You're in good company, Jim. And be happy you're getting some errors, because it's a learning experience. So that's one of the steps I would do, and I wonder if that makes some sense to you. And if not, ask me some more questions, and I'll give you some more illumination on this one. KD2BHY, heating up the world with transmitters, K2RIW. Go ahead, Jim.
I don't know, that made a lot of sense. My second question is a quick one. It's about these, I found five tubes in an old aircraft receiver that I got a while ago at a ham fest for $5. And they're all, here, let me check the numbers on them. Here. One of them is a 12BA6. One is a 35W4. One is a 12BA6. One is a 14GTB. And the last one is a 35EH5. Do you have any information on any of these tubes and what they do?
To the old timers, they will recognize almost every one of those except maybe the 35EH5. That's a slightly rare one. But all those other tubes are oldies but goodies. They've been around for years and years. Back in the days of early television sets, 1950s, 1960s, way before you were born, even in the early 1970s, I remember using some of those tubes. I think the 12BA6 is a pentode, often used in IF strips. The 35W4, I think, is a kind of a rectifier. That could be the power rectifier one, and so on. So my guess is you can Google those numbers. They'll give you information. I know that people who collect antique radios, like Rich, N2EO, will recognize those numbers right away. He's got sitting on his shelf a tube manual, an RCA tube manual, where every one of those tubes is listed. In fact, I own that manual, and maybe a little bit later on I'll go to the shelf and get it, and I can read you those tubes. The RCA tube manual, a very famous paperback book, all about half an inch thick. It's a little bit bigger than a 3x5 card. It's not an 8.5x11. It's not a full-size book, if you know what I mean. Nice compact book that people would shove in their toolbox when they were going out doing television servicing in the early days. Let me drop. And you turn to the right page. It shows you a picture of the diagram of the internal layout of that tube, and it gives you a whole bunch of listings as to filament voltage, filament current, plate voltage, plate current, average operating conditions, what voltage you put on the screen grid, and so on. So those two manuals will give you a lot of information. And fermionic emission devices are the words that we use for hollow state vacuum devices, in other words, vacuum tubes. Almost everything these days is transistorized when it comes to radios, receiving systems. Tubes are still being used in high power transmitters, but in receivers these days, almost everything is transistorized. So you're going to be looking into some interesting history. There's lots of people you can go to that will recognize those tubes. There are various people. In fact, if you just put out the word that you would like to have a copy of the RCA tube manual,
Y in Glen Cove, and you'll be able to look up all of these tubes directly. The earlier versions of the Radio Amateur's Handbook had a section on tubes in the back where those tubes were listed. I don't know if the Radio Amateur's Handbook, the modern day version, still does, but for years and years and years, the back of the Radio Amateur's Handbook would give you that information. So there's lots of places you can find out what you've got there, Jim. KD2BHY, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Thanks, Nick. I was pretty excited when I found them, and I didn't really know what to do with them. I was thinking maybe I could use one in a later transmitter or something like that, but thanks for that information, and I'll definitely look for that book on a website or something. Back to Nick.
FBM.
I kind of thought Rich would pipe up. Rich collects antique radios. Guarantee he knows, he recognizes every one of those tubes. They're oldies and goodies that he's, they're all friends of his. I try to hold your handy-talky in the position where we hear you well, Rich. You do drop out a little bit. And so tell us, Rich, where you believe Jim should go to get the next piece of information, and who should he suggest that either loan or give a tube manual to Jim so he can look these up directly. But I think some of the older versions of the Radio Options Handbook also have that information. N2 Echo Oscar, and where you located these days, Rich, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very, very good. So, you know, if he goes online and looks up some of those tube numbers, there are some people that keep database on these tubes. I'm trying to remember the tail letters. I think one of them is W7JD or something like that. Keeps a database on all the tubes. So that's one resource. And Dick, I'm home. I'm no longer in the hospital. I'm home. My house is sold, and we're looking to move to Lindenhurst in the next month or so. Back to next.
Yeah, I do remember you saying that you packed up all your stuff, so you knew that the sale was coming pretty fast. I know that you also got an offer on your house very rapidly. So it looks like Lindenhurst, which I think is the, is it Bayshore? I think it's the Bayshore Township, which from what we can tell by way of the main ham radio installation being right in the town hall of Bayshore, sounds like it's a township that's pretty friendly to ham radio. Therefore, you should be able to put up lots of, you and Barry should be able to put lots of antennas on the roof of that house and on the garage and so on. So, okay. So there's lots of places where he can go, and I guarantee somebody's eventually going to give Jim. There's a slim, slim chance, not guaranteeing it, but I own two separate copies of the RCA tube manual. And if I do, there's a chance I'll be mailing one of those to Jim. So glad to hear you're back at home, Rich, and probably on the mend after that last procedure that you spent in the hospital. Looks like all the important people won't go to a hospital these days. At the beginning of December, I was there for 3 days. John, KC2WGB, he was in the hospital for, I believe it was 9 days recently. Rich has been in the hospital twice. So all the important people are going to the hospital. You guys haven't been to the hospital, you don't know what you're missing. It's a bit of a joke in that one. Okay, thank you, Rich. And Jim, guarantee you're going to be getting some more information with your particular projects. The next person on the list was Bradley, Andy, KD2DIF, and Nanuet, New York. I should know where that is. And so, what would you like to talk to us about tonight, Brady? KD2DIF, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Thanks. Thank you, sir. K2LIW, KD2DIF here. Well, the backstory is that recently the apartment building that I lived in installed a RFID-operated garage door. And the RFID tags are designed to be placed specifically into a laminated windshield. And apparently these tags somehow use the laminated windshield as some sort of synthetic radiator, which is something that's kind of a mystery to me. It's not something that I learned about when I learned about RF 30 years ago. So I was wondering if somebody could explain how that works and how, I know that's microwave and not UHF or VHF, but I wonder if that can be exploited by ham radios.
My goodness, Brady, have you asked the right question to the right person? I have spent the last 10 years of my life working with and for organizations that build radio frequency identification tags, radio frequency identification readers, or transponders, as they call them. And so you want to know how it works, and you can have a lot of fun with a person knowing that this passive object, which usually is a thousandth or a couple thousandth of an inch thick, quite often it's in the vicinity of 5 or 6 inches long, an inch or so wide, this so-called RFID tag, which comes in many forms, small, large, round, square, rectangular, and so on. They all have pretty much the same principle of operation. Let me drop for a second. When it comes to passive RFID devices, for 10 or 15 years, there was a low-frequency version of these running at 13.56 megacycles, which has a coil of wire. It's the object is placed up against the side of the box of a unit at a store, like a television set. And if any of those things go out the front door, there's a detector telling you that. So some of these things work at 125 KC. Some of them work at 13.56 megacycles. 98% of them run at 915 megacycles. There's a whole bunch of reasons why that magic frequency. It's a frequency left over that no one is using per se for industrial commercial equipment, license free. So at 902 to 928 megacycle band, we call it the 915 meg band, those are the RFID tags that give you the greatest range. Your easy pass that you paste against the windshield of your automobile runs at 915 megacycles. And as you go through that toll booth, you can be 20 feet away from the toll booth. It is reading that tag. Now, I'm going to explain what the word reading means. Let me drop. The tag is called a transponder. The thing that wants to read it, transponder? Yeah, you call it a transponder. The reader, the thing that wants to read the tag, sends out a approximately 1 watt signal at approximately 915 megacycles. There's a whole bunch of complication there. It doesn't sit on any one frequency. It hops from frequency to frequency every 100 milliseconds or so in order not to jam any one particular channel of that license-free band 902 to 928. I won't go there yet. But it sends out a CW signal. The passive tags, not the one that's on, that's EasyPass. EasyPass has a battery inside, giving it greater sensitivity and greater range. But the majority of the ones that are on high-value items in stores these days, there is no battery on board. What it literally does is that if the reader is within, let me pick a number, 20 feet, enough of the signal is picked up by the dipole on the passive tag. There is a Schottky diode-like rectifier, which rectifies the RF voltage that appears on that dipole of the tag. The rectified voltage charges the capacitor. The capacitor becomes a temporary battery. The temporary battery runs the integrated circuit that's on board. That integrated circuit, by the way, is so small, you almost can't see it with your eye. It's less than a millimeter square and much smaller than that thick, and you got to look at it with a microscope. But you're powering that very elaborate integrated circuit, which has got a clock on board, and it's got an address. Most of the tags have been programmed with an address that is 96 bits long. So you turn on this transmitter, and the tag spits back its 96-bit code. Your interrogator reads that code and says, aha, I recognize that as a pair of jeans, size so-and-so.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Once you know that address number, the computer in the store looks up that number and says, yes, that's designer jeans, brand so-and-so, size such-and-such, and the fact that they're on that shelf when you're doing inventory, you know that you don't have to restock that particular size of that particular brand. I just gave you an example of how these things work. Can hams use these things? Oh, there's a zillion ways you can use these tags. And how does that thing transmit back that 96 bits? You ask the average person, okay, you're transmitting a signal to the thing, it's sending a signal back. The receiver has, something in the vicinity of 50 kilohertz of bandwidth that's doing the receiver. inside of the interrogator, the thing that's doing the reading, and you ask the average person, okay, that thing that transmits back, what transmitting frequency accuracy does it have at 915 megs? If you and I were building a free-running oscillator transmitter at 915 megs, we would have a devil of a time keeping that transmitter to the nearest 10 megacycles of the right frequency, particularly when the tag is sometimes being plastered up against a piece of metal, sometimes against a piece of glass, sometimes a piece of wood, and that detunes things. So how would you keep it to the nearest 10 megacycles? You ask the average electronic engineer, what accuracy does that tag have? And the answer is better than 1 hertz, but it doesn't even have a crystal on board. How in the world does it do that? It does that by transmitting back to you, the guy holding the interrogator. It transmits your own signal back to you. It doesn't generate its own signal. What it does is it periodically, with a digital code, it does the equivalent of putting short circuits and open circuits on its own dipole antenna, which modulates the what's called the radar cross-section. Whenever you aim a radar signal at an airplane, let me drop. Depending on what was the orientation of the metal of the airplane, how big is the airplane, how far away, you get a specific amount of echo whenever you aim a radar signal at, say, an airplane. The magnitude of the echo you get from that airplane, to the scientists that do that quantifying, they call it radar cross-section, okay? You change the orientation of the airplane so the flat sheet of metal on the side of the fuselage is aimed toward you, you get a great big echo. You change the orientation of the airplane so that it's aimed in some other direction, you get a very weak echo. In the first case, you've got a strong radar cross-section. In the second case, you've got a weak radar cross-section. By putting shorts and open circuits on the dipole of the tag, the little integrated circuit does that periodically. It modulates the radar cross-section. Your interrogating receiver looks at that signal jumping up and down in amplitude. It reads that code. Very ingenious circuit. Those tags are proposed to be as cheap as 5 cents a piece in the future. Right now, they run more like 30 cents a piece. Inexpensive ones. People are predicting that with mass production sometime later, they're going to be 5 cents a piece. You're going to be scattering them all over the place. Where you've got barcodes right now, which only have 14 bits of information, in the average case, on all of the things in the supermarket, some of the higher value items are going to have RFID tags in the future, where instead of having 14 bits of code, which is very too small, and it gives you ambiguity problems at times, you have 96 bits on the simple tag, and there are more elaborate tags with more bits than that can spit back to you. This is an industry that's in its infancy right now, very similar to the way barcodes were in, let me say, 1970, and it's something that's going to